Welcome to the second part of my conversation with Vincent Bevins, author of If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. In part one of the discussion, we spoke about the politics of protest in the 2010s in democracies. And so we focused on Brazil and Chile and then also discussed the UK. In this second part, we move on to the politics of protest in non-democracies, with a focus on Egypt and the Arab Spring. And I have to say, it's in this latter group of countries that I feel much less certain about my politics or what conclusions I should draw from the experience of the 2010s. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, when it comes to the democracies, I'm pretty clear where I stand, right? I'm a bog standard social democrat. I'm into protests to the extent they can bring about positive reforms, but I think mounting protests with revolutionary pretensions are usually unproductive and often likely to backfire. And that's pretty much the lesson I take from the failure of the horizontalist anarcho-esque protests for free travel that challenged the authority of the democratically elected Brazilian Workers' Party. Now, as you will have hopefully heard in part one of this discussion, that movement initially mobilized lots of people, but it also led to a political situation which damaged the president of the Social Democrat, Dilma Rousseff, and empowered the right. If those movements, the movement for free travel, had any lasting consequence, it seems likely it was a negative one. Now, that's unfortunate for the people involved, who I'm sure were well-intentioned, good, smart people. To the extent that they paved the way for the fall of Rousseff, it also had bad consequences for the working class people of Brazil. But on an intellectual level, for a bog standard social democrat, the political lessons from Brazil aren't especially challenging, right? If you want change in a democracy, join a social democratic party or an organized trade union. Don't just try and get your way by holding endless participatory meetings, chanting revolutionary slogans, and blocking streets, right? It's risky to go for those latter options. However, and this goes without saying, really, if I lived in Egypt, I wouldn't have a similar option. If you want to exert real political agency in a country governed by an insular and repressive autocracy, you can't just say, oh, why not join a social democratic party? Why not join a trade union? Why not have a nice, peaceful reformist protest? No, in a social structure like that, it's often the case that revolutionary protest really is the only game in town. And that's what hundreds of thousands of people did in Egypt in 2011.
A new dawn in Cairo. But on this first morning of the bright new era in this country, there is a haze of uncertainty in Egypt. In Tahrir Square this morning, the first signs of change. While cleaning the square may seem trivial, the small army of volunteers who came out to push brooms and pick up trash are citizens of a new country now, and they are taking ownership of it.
We came here to clean Egypt because Egypt is ours.
Less than 24 hours ago, it was sheer jubilation in Tahrir after the news that President Mubarak had resigned. And after 18 days of a people's protest that had Egypt on a knife edge, the party this country had last night was incredible.
That was part of a rather giddy report from ABC News on the day after Mubarak's resignation. And the protesters did get their principal demand. In 2012, a democratic multi-party election was held, and a full 13 candidates stood in its first round. However, in the runoff, so when there were only two candidates in the race, the two winners from that first round, when the runoff happened, the glow had already faded from Egypt's democratic transition. Well, at least that's from the perspective of the Western media.
Voting already underway, meantime, in another closely watched election in Egypt tonight. After the people there revolted, driving Hosni Mubarak from power, that elation in Tahrir Square. But now come major questions about whether their revolution has been hijacked. ABC's Alex Marquardt is standing watch at a busy polling station in Cairo tonight. Alex.
Good evening, David. The excitement that we saw at the beginning of this historic election has given way to a sense of foreboding and, for many, fear. The next Egyptian president will either be an Islamist from the Muslim Brotherhood or Mubarak's last prime minister. And that has left many of the so-called revolutionaries with a very tough choice in a very close race.
Egyptians would ultimately choose the Muslim Brotherhood's Mohamed Morsi as their first democratically elected president. But the experiment with democracy wouldn't last long. Within a year, Morsi was overthrown by the military, and in a curious inversion of the 2011 revolution, it was the end of Egyptian democracy that was now cheered on from Tahrir Square.
Fireworks and jubilation erupted in Tahrir Square tonight as the military announced it dissolved Egypt's constitution and deposed President Mohamed Morsi after just 1 year in office. In a speech to the nation, the head of the military said they were responding to the calls of the people. The military also blamed Morsi for failing to unite Egyptians.
If the Egyptian military would go on to unite the country where Morsi failed, it would only be at the barrel of a gun. On the 14th of August 2013, security forces massacred around 1,000 Morsi supporters who had mounted their own protest in a different Cairo square. The following year, General Sisi was formally sworn in as Egypt's new dictator. He still holds that role, and Egypt is governed in a manner that's even more repressive than the 30 years Hosni Mubarak was in power. And that wholly depressing outcome is not unique to Egypt when it comes to the Arab Spring. In Bahrain, protests were put down very quickly with Saudi support. In Syria, the country suffered a decade-long, incredibly bloody civil war. In Libya, Western intervention to help overthrow Gaddafi paved the way for state collapse. And Tunisia, which was once seen as the one real success story of the Arab Spring, has veered back towards authoritarian rule and economic stagnation. Much of my conversation with Vincent in this part of the interview centers around the question of whether these outcomes were contingent or whether they were inevitable. And also, more provocatively, I think, whether the risk of things getting much worse is a case for small-c conservatism. And this might seem like a strange thing to be posing on a podcast by someone who I'm sure you sort of associate with a left-wing tradition. I mean, I do associate myself with that. But I do think when you look around the world at, you know, protests which often cause an incredible amount of excitement and enthusiasm around the world, you know, if you check the scorecard 5 or 10 years later, it's often the case that things have got worse. Now, obviously, this is not an argument to not protest or to not make political change or not to try make political change, but it is a provocation. And in our discussion of the sometimes unintended consequences of political action, how sort of well-intentioned motives can lead to bad outcomes or often have led to bad outcomes, we also talk about the case of the Soviet Union, where what I think were really admirable reforms under Gorbachev led to state collapse and ultimately a collapse in the life expectancy of Russians.
Let's talk about the Arab Spring. Clearly, as we've said, the most spectacular protest wave of the 2010s, really the thing that sort of launches, in a way, these protests in squares. And Egypt is the most significant one, mainly because it's the most significant country, population of 100 million, and most populous country in the Arab world. By 2011, its president Hosni Mubarak has been in power for 30 years, but after 18 days of protests, he resigns.
Yep.
That's, you know, that's crazy. That's world historic significance. Yep. How does an autocrat of 30 years get overthrown in 18 days of protests in squares?
Well, the really oversimplified and slightly cynical answer is he loses the support of the military, which is why it becomes quite strange to see this spectacle not only serving as inspiration but as a template for movements elsewhere. Because in a very, very narrow, you know, incomplete narrative of what happens in Cairo in 2011 is you have a military coup. Now, a military coup, which I think it should be clear, does not always have to be progressive, right? A military coup can be progressive in relationship to the thing that comes before. If a military coup ends a monarchy and creates a republic, if a military coup, which is, you know, how Brazil was born, essentially, if a military coup ends a dictatorship and then there's really are free and fair elections, then in which Egyptians are allowed to select leaders going forward. A military coup doesn't always have to be, you know, a Pinochet-style military coup. But narrowly, that's the answer. The longer answer is that in Tunisia, you have a revolution, which I don't necessarily, I'll be oversimplifying, but it goes more or less like you expect a North African revolution to go. It does start in the middle of the country. There is mediation. There is, you know, there are viral stories. But you can watch as discrete groups in civil society, whether they are political parties or the mass union organization, UGTT, professional groups, you can watch as like identifiable parts of society join the uprising until the guy flees. I think he flees to Saudi Arabia. In Egypt, what you have in January is a group of people coming together. As I said, they've often come together through pro-Palestine organizing. They plan a protest on January 25th, in which they don't even plan to call for the end of the Mubarak government. They are protesting police brutality. Now, they know that the Tunisia uprising is going to probably inspire people to come out. They are hopeful that a lot of people will come out, but a lot of people don't go because they think, ah, this will be one of those, you know, usual suspects. Granted, me and my friends, we're going to get, you know, go try to get to the square.
This is a lot of the left-wing militants who don't go, right?
Yeah, even some people that
like
are...
another protest.
Well, people that are sympathetic. The real militants, of course, are there. But the people that are sympathetic or know these people, I'm not going to go to this one, you know, it's going to be the same thing. We're going to try to take the square. It's not going to work. Fights with the cops, go home. A lot more people show up than expected. A lot more. To the point that on 28th, the second protest 3 days later, so many people show up that you actually have a battle with the police in the streets of Cairo, and the police lose. The police run away. The police rip off their uniforms and disappear into the night. You have defeated the forces of repression. At least, you can't defeat the military unless you have like a guerrilla war. But you defeated the police. The military is on the sidelines. And in that moment, you could have perhaps done anything. And so a lot of people told me that had left Egypt or are still living under, you know, the Sisi government, we wish we would have seized organs of power. We wish we would have seized the television station and put out sort of a revolutionary message. This would have been sort of the Portuguese model, is that like the you think that the military is sort of kind of okay with what's going on, and then you have like,
are we talking is it the end of Salazar? I don't know much about the situation.
Yeah, because that is really a military coup, basically, initially, but the military is quite sympathetic to the left and allows people to, you know, get out their message. But in this moment, you could have done anything, but none of this was planned for. So the people did what they always do. They took the square and they stayed in the square. And this allowed people like me and you to show up and say, oh, they're doing a carnival of prefiguration. They're forming new bonds there. This is and some people believe this. Some Egyptians believe this. But, you know, as you know, not that many, you know, the whole country wasn't there.
Right.
It was necessarily a small minority of people that are in the square. And then you get attempts at repression, which fail, cause more outpouring of sympathy. But eventually, really what happens is the military fight. And this is, you know, this is the beginning of the book, but, you know, crude revolutionary history is that two things can happen. Security forces can defect, or you can win a civil war. That's it. Because if the army wants to kill you and you can't beat them in a war, then they will kill you, right? So really concretely what happens is the military withdraws support. And there's all kinds of reasons if you actually study the Egyptian political system and, you know, jockeying behind the scenes for the future of the country. Mubarak wanted to put his son in power. This really upset a lot of people, etc. You could explain why the military was sort of open to this kind of a...
Mubarak was going to put his son in power, and they thought this was now becoming a sort of hereditary...
Yes, this had caused a lot of discontent for a while, because his son was seen as a real kind of like Western style neoliberal, which upset not only the left but also the military. And the Egyptian left is very, very strong. The Egyptian left is historically very strong, and in the elections that are held in 2012, you can rerun. You know, it's always easy to do this in retrospect, but the military does put on elections. It's not clear that they're going to, but they do. And some people think that they're not going to be real, but they are. They seem to be probably the most legitimate elections that have ever taken place. And you can rerun those elections I said, it's easy to do so from now in a way that a social democrat wins. There's a man, you know, Hamid Sabahi, he tells me later, I interview him, he says that his inspiration was Lula. So one, you can have, so to answer your question, what would have I done? Some people can say, well, no, actually there was a power vacuum and that was a moment for a revolutionary vanguard to seize power and then make a bid to see if the people followed them. You know, you'd have to kind of grab the television station, put out a revolutionary message. And if the people, you know, you're going to fall apart quite quickly if you don't get support of quite a lot of the military and a lot of people.
You are risking then that if you lose, you get executed.
Yes.
Or if you half win, you get a civil war.
Yes.
So the stakes are very high.
The stakes are always very high in an insurrection. I mean, this is, you know.
Well, in an authoritarian system, I mean.
Doing a revolution halfway is, you know, famously one of the most dangerous things you can do. So one narrative says, well, no, there was the opportunity to just actually seize power in that moment. Of course, we couldn't like create an entirely new state, but we could create sort of, you know, revolutionary committees of some kind or put out But again, who would have done that? It would have been, number one, no one had planned for this. And to do that would have implied someone stepping forward and acting in a vanguard fashion. And it just, I don't know if it could have, I don't know if it couldn't have, it didn't happen. Another narrative says, well, the thing to do was to really, in 2012, create the electoral coalition, which would allow the secular, some version of the progressive secular political forces, which again, there's quite a lot of them in the country, to win. But then there was a small minority of people in this. And then again, in so many of the cases in the book, it's really quite a small number of people that really believe in like the full horizontalist thesis or in the full post-ideological, like the riot will become the new state version of politics. What you get is an elective affinity often between what is possible, what the media want to see, and some elements that exist, you know, in the air ideologically. So there are some people in the square in 2011 that say, no, this is the beginning of the new society. And there's quite a few people in 2012 that say that either boycott the election or say refuse to participate because they, and those people told me that they wish they had. I think everybody that I asked about this says, I wish we would have participated more vigorously in the 2012 election, because it turned out that it was real and it turned out that just more labor action wasn't going to secure a path to the Egypt we wanted to see.
Well, one thing from your book that I hadn't, you know, obviously this is not original research from you, the election result, but one thing sort of I had in my mind, because all I remembered was the sort of the runoff. So the runoff between the Muslim Brotherhood and the army. And so the impression I had was essentially that you had these sort of protests, which weren't, you know, there might have been some small groups who organized them, but essentially it was a fairly unorganized group of civil society who had been mobilized by Twitter.
The vast majority of people that showed up were not part of some organization.
Yeah, so powerful enough to bring down Mubarak, but not really powerful enough to fill the vacuum. And the only forces who were organized enough, you know, in decades of Mubarak's Egypt, were the Muslim Brotherhood and the army. And so inevitably that vacuum would be filled by either the Muslim Brotherhood or the army. And so, you know, you have that neat runoff between the two. But I hadn't realized that, you know, the first round of those elections was actually quite close. So Morsi got 25%, not overwhelming. Shafiq, he was the Mubarak. So Morsi, obviously the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, gets 25%. Shafiq, the continuity Mubarak candidate, so the military guy, he gets 24%. But then you've got, I'm going to butcher these pronunciations. So Sabahi.
Yes, sure.
Sabahi. So he's the Nasserist Social Democrat.
Yep.
21%. And then you've got Fatou. He's the independent progressive Islamist on 17%.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and the army combined get less than 50%. So it could have gone a different way.
There's so many reasons why the Egyptian case to me is by far the most interesting. Obviously, I know more about Brazil. I don't speak Arabic. I didn't live in Egypt. But the Egyptian case is so fascinating. One, because it's at the heart of what's going on now in Palestine. It's at the heart. I mean, Egypt has always been at the heart of the Arab world. It's, as you say, it's the most populous country. Nasserism, Arab socialism, really inspired people back in the 20th century. And this is a big part. This is a big reason why the United States started backing Israel and Saudi Arabia so aggressively.
So Nasser, sort of Arab socialist, he wants a developmentalist model, sort of.
Yeah, he's anti-imperialist. He wants Arab unity, and he wants some kind of a social. You know, it is authoritarian domestically to greater or lesser degrees over the course. But yeah, Arab socialism is quite inspiring, and it really scares the United States in the 20th century. So Egypt is fascinating because it's so central to the Arab world. It's fascinating because it's so central to what's happening in Palestine. And three, like you could, like you can't really rerun Syria and kind of be like, oh, well, that was the way to do it, and then you get to win. You can, you can't really rerun, as you say, Brazil. It's like, well, maybe you rerun it and you just
don't do it. Yeah.
Whereas in Egypt, you could say, you could point to, you could really see it working, and you could see it. You know, if Hamdi Sabahi, if Nasser, a social democrat, gets elected, you know, when the Sisi coup happens in 2013, the Obama administration finds a way to hand-wring and be like, oh, I guess we have to support this military coup for the first time in U.S. history, support, you know, a military coup that's, you know, useful to our geopolitical interests. What would they do? How would they deal with a Egypt run by a Nasser, a social democrat, which is being quite loud about opposition to neoliberalism and to Israel?
Let's talk about that coup as well, because this is another... So in Brazil, you've got this sort of...
Reversal.
This narrative, this reversal, where you've got this left-wing people in the street, yay, you know, people in the square, we love it. And then by 2016, you've got, oh, people in the square, oh no, but they're right-wing and reactionary.
Right.
In Egypt, you have a sort of somewhat similar narrative.
Yeah, you
right?
have the...
2011, you got, these are democracy protesters in the square, and then you've got 2013. The whole West is looking at this, by the way, saying, oh, this is the second round of the revolution because the Muslim Brotherhood who've been elected are being too authoritarian. This is going to project this to the next phase of the revolution.
Right.
But really, they're just in the square asking for the dictatorship back, or some of them are.
Well, concretely, historically, and again, this is objectively what is being asked for, but subjectively, this is not what many people say that they were asking for. So what you get is, yes, you get 2011, which is just like in Brazil, you know, the biggest, you know, protests in Egyptian history. And then 2013 actually exceeds. So what happens? You know, this part of the story is more familiar. I think Morsi is Muslim Brotherhood candidate. He wins. He does a bad, you know, there is a mix of just bad governance and authoritarian, an authoritarian turn. I don't think anybody, except for perhaps like people that are very close to him, think he did a great job. Mm. But in a democracy, the way that works is maybe the first guy, you know.
Maybe the Nasserite could have got elected.
Yeah, the second Muslim Brotherhood, you know, doesn't do a great job and then loses, right? So that's how, that, you know, that's how a lot of new democracies go, is that the first couple of administrations do a poor job and then are replaced by somebody else. What you have is the formation, and this is a word that I always have a hard time pronouncing, but there's a group called Tamarod, which... just like the MBL in Brazil, presents itself as the continuation of the original revolutionary spirit of Egypt. They're collecting signatures to petition for the end of the Morsi presidency. And then there is a mass protest movement in June 2013, as it happens the same month. I mean, this is perhaps why you weren't paying attention to what happened in Brazil. I was living through it, but you were maybe watching to see what was happening in Egypt. And so people told me, and they recounted this, and they said, well, yeah, I was, you know, I didn't like Morsi, I don't like the Muslim Brotherhood. So I went to those protests, but it was quite strange. Whereas in 2011, we were fighting cops. In 2013, like, everybody seemed to be on our, like, the military was flying overhead, and, like, it seemed like a nationalist parade rather than some kind of revolt from below. And what this does is it paves the road for the Sisi coup. So Sisi just seizes power, and he doesn't call for new elections. You know, the military doesn't call for new elections this time. This is just a coup. Sisi's still the president. Immediately massacring supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, who, as in...
lots of them as well, right?
Yeah, like, about 1,000.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I'm not an Islamist, and as poor a job as Morsi did in from 2011 to 2013, this is the only elected government in the history of Egypt.
And the massacre is more... So that's another actual, you know, square protest.
Well, yes, it's Rabah Square. It's a different square.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing that Western media would have sort of been looking like, oh, this is a beautiful protest in a square. But because they were Islamists, 1,000 of them get killed, and people are sort of like, oh, you know, that's...
We have to fight terrorism in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And just kind of nothing happens. And then Sisi's just still in power. And you go, you know... Quite a lot of people that lived through 2011, made 2011 happen, are either in jail or had to flee the country. A lot of them will say that things are much, much worse than the Mubarak dictatorship. When I went there, I experienced like the type, I mean, I've, you know, I haven't been out everywhere, but I've been around a bit. And it was the most intense repression that I'd experienced, even just as like, usually as like a foreign Western journalist, there's somebody you can meet up with and be like, what do you think about the government? If you do that in Egypt, people say, like, shut up. We can't talk about this here. Someone will call the cops on us.
And I suppose is this a sort of classic situation of when your revolution fails, which is sort of you have a similar government to before because you've had a counter revolution,
right?
But they're more authoritarian because they're terrified that the revolution will happen again.
So yeah, the question of how Sisi understands his relationship to 2011 is quite an interesting one, because on the one hand, he must claim that he is the inheritor of the legacy of 2011. On the other, he seems terrified of this happening again. So like the physical manifestation of this is like in Tahrir Square, like in the middle of the square, there's a big monument to the revolution of 2011. And I, like, as a tourist, was like, oh, I'll go check that. You can't go anywhere near it. There's cops. Cops
but
will
why
stop.
Can't you go near it? Because
you can't go in.
Because they're worried that there'll be another protest around it.
Cops just don't let you do anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is just, what are you doing here? Like, stop. What are you looking at this for? Right. You're doing politics. Foreigners are supposed to come here to go to the pyramids, not to do politics. Why are you doing politics? And so, yeah, so this is a thing that emerges across the book. And this is a moment where it becomes quite important to remember that most of the uprisings are in, all of the uprisings in the book are outside of the traditional first world. And that this recipe, this package of contention that I spoke about at the beginning, was put together by people that did not have direct experience of, or did not center imperialism in the global system. Because often what you got in the 2010s is after this moment of apparent success, of euphoric victory, you get counter-revolution with the carried out by global imperialist forces. You get some kind of the biggest guy in the neighborhood that invades, or you get the biggest country in the global neighborhood, the United States, to support some reactionary faction. So even a mass of individuals that are concretely horizontal and came together through a shared distaste for a post. And that's, you know, being oversimplifying things and being a bit unkind, but a mass of people that comes together because of a shared rejection of something or because they're disgusted with a particular thing that they've saw. If it's not very well suited to carry out something like a revolution, if it's not very suited to enter a power vacuum or to elaborate a set of demands, it's certainly not well constituted to withstand a counterattack, to withstand a counter-revolutionary attack. And then, again, this is all part of the like classic 20th century, like officially codified, like Marxist-Leninist canon. Like even back then, they were saying, well, it is kind of annoying to have, you know, this is not the words that they would have used. It is, you know, we understand, you know, opposition to this insistence on iron discipline. This is, you know, people don't like this, but, you know, you won't withstand the inevitable counter-revolution unless you can act as a collective. And so in many, many cases in the so-called Arab Spring, this is what really happens, is that you get the imperial counterattack, and it comes in different forms in different countries. In Bahrain, it's quite obvious. And Bahrain is a country where it's really obvious why people hated. It's like, these are like medieval concerns. It's like there's a monarchy from the minority religion that represses the majority. But what happens is when the conditions, you know, when that regime is threatened, Saudi Arabia just marches over the bridge and just crushes it. Just like, oh, you got the imperial counterattack. And in the case of the Egyptian military, you know, there was a moment when people were saying, you know, the people and the military are one hand. You know, like there was an idea at the beginning of 2011 about the unity between protesters and military. Some people thought this, just like Portugal went in 1974. By 2013, if the army with all the weapons has a very strong opinion about how things are going to go, it's going to go that way. Just like Assad in Syria, after he watches what happens in Libya. I mean, it's not just Assad. I mean, who knows what Assad himself would have done. But after what happens in Libya, which is that very legitimate and very real opposition to Gaddafi's government, is used as a pretext for NATO to launch a bombing campaign, which ends up destroying the country. It still has not been put back together. Some leaders just decide, well, I'm just going to crush the movement. As long as I can keep the security forces on side, as long as I can keep the military hierarchy loyal to me, I can just kill them. And if I don't lose a war, then that's it. You know, it becomes clear by 2013, 2012, that proving to the world that the leader is wrong or bad is not enough. And this is, of course, relevant to what's happening now with Palestine protests, right? Like you have to defeat or take power away from somebody rather than just prove that they are misusing power, because maybe they just say, okay, well, I am, but I have it. What are you going to do? And the dynamic of imperialism and the dynamics of counterattack and counter-revolution rear their heads in a way which was not expected in the 2010s, especially in North Africa, often because success was not even planned for. Things got so much bigger, so much faster than anybody had even hoped for.
Looking at the Arab Spring more broadly, this is, you know, nowhere seems to be improved, right? So you have Egypt, where you have, you know, this idealistic attempt at a revolution leads to a counter-revolution and a regime that's even more authoritarian than the one it replaced. Syria, I mean, untold misery, a decade-long civil war. Bahrain, as you say, sort of was repressed quite quickly. And some people might actually say that the Bahraini option was the best one, right? Because, you know, their economy is still somewhat stable. They haven't had a year of sort of, or a decade of failed states, as some places have.
I mean, that's quite a horrible... I mean, that really is a quite pessimistic reading to say... A crackdown is better than a decade long civil war. But I mean, you know, things can always, yeah, like you said, you know,
but I mean, that's the provocation I want to put to you essentially, which is, right. Is this sort of an argument for small C conservatism? I'll finish the list though, because then you've got, as you say, Libya, Western intervention, state failure, civil war. Tunisia was sort of put forward as the positive example, but actually they're, you know, that seems somewhat.
They put together a new government, which proved, you know, over the course of the decade, less and less convincing to really anyone. I mean, really, even I spoke to Tunisian MPs that were convinced by the end of the decade that the government wasn't working. So,
yeah. So, I mean, you said it's a very cynical way to look at that, to say, you know, the repressive regime sort of just riding it out very quickly. So that is a depressing and cynical way of looking at it. But how would you argue against that?
That there are better and worse times to select the moment for an insurrection, that the choice is not between doing nothing or doing something that leads to a civil war and disaster. The choice is between better or worse times in better or worse ways, better or worse times to launch an insurrection, if there is the conditions for one at all, and better or worse ways to wage a struggle. So again, even in the very, very radical like traditions of the 20th century, people that really like believed in doing revolution all the time, like, you know, the classic like revolution with the Vanguard, would say that it was important to analyze very, very carefully when the right moment to act is, and to make sure to pick a terrain where your enemy is weak and where you are strong. Understanding that not every time is the best time to do something, and not everything is the best thing to do. So I think the choice... I hope that it's a false dilemma between the Bahraini and the Syrian option, because there are a range of ways that you can wage political struggle. And if you're going to if you're going to opt for the general insurrection, there are myriad possible moments of opportunity for that kind of thing in the future. The question is whether or not doing something right now, because it happened in another country with slightly different or quite different political circumstances, means that it's time to do it now. I think historically that has been proven to be sometimes useful. There's like, you do have revolutionary waves in history. You have times where, okay, a lot of people have inspired, you know, things are happening all over Europe because people are getting news of these other, you know, inspired by these other revolutions. But yeah, hopefully it's not that false dilemma between doing nothing and doing something which ends up to be quite painful. Hopefully I believe if I didn't believe there was a lot more options on the table, there'd be no point in sort of interrogating all these cases so carefully. You could just say, oh, don't do anything. Everything is just chaos, and just don't rock the boat. Just things are fine.
That was the first part of the second part of my interview with Vincent Bevins. In the latter half of this episode, we discuss the collapse of the Soviet Union, whether anti-imperialist governments tend to be forced to be authoritarian, and we debate the utility of revolutionary activism versus gardening. To listen to the rest, you can sign up via patreon.com/crashcoursepod. Membership is from £3 a month, or you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. Crash Course is produced and edited by Lewis Bassett and Patrick Herpin. Patrick Herpin does the sound design.